Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs will be here for the first segment of the program, and then Alfred Adesk will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the balance of the show. And today is Thursday, January 15th, 2015. We'll begin with a market report before we go to Wendy. She's got some great discussions about your health and medical tests and how dangerous some of those tests can be. But first, we had a tremendous day in the gold market today. Of course, that was following the Swiss franc. You had a surprise decision from the Swiss National Bank. They abandoned the cap on the currency value against the euro. And some big moves in the market. And what's interesting, and I think the thing that struck me the most about this whole deal with the Swiss National Bank ending the trade to the euro was it came as a complete surprise. And I believe this is what these little black swans are all about. Things will come as a complete surprise. No one expected it. And, of course, we had these big moves in the markets. Next time, or a very similar time, probably be the dollar where we'll experience this type of a drop. And ours did drop. It did recover. And some really interesting moves in the markets today. We had gold currently now up $27 at $1,257. We had a high of $1,268. Silver today was up over $17 most of the day. Trading at $16.95. Platinum was up $27 at $1,256, with palladium down 10 at $769. And as I mentioned, the dollar did recover a little bit in the index, up 0.24 at 92.31. Crude oil was down $2 today at $46.39. Paper markets today, you know, early morning trade, they were up, you know, triple digits. They came down triple digits. They went up. They came down. They were just all over the page today, but they didn't end that bad with the Dow being down. Well, they did make it. It turned around in the last, hour of trade, down 104 at 17,322. European markets, after all that with the Swiss and the currency, they didn't fare that bad. We'll see what they do tonight. But the NASDAQ was down 68 points at 4,570. You had the S&P down 18, 1,992. And the 10-year yield is at an incredible 1.78%, 1.78% down 0.06. So, you know, the questions being about, and this is we real quick before we go to Wendy, is it makes you wonder what the Swiss National Bank knows, what's going to happen to the euro or to the European Union. Of course, we had that stimulus announcement coming from Draghi next week. And they know that the market will be, you know, flooded. The price of the euro will be dropping. It should drop, lose a lot of value after those announcements are made by Draghi. And so are the Swiss just looking to escape a sinking ship? And they also dropped their rates by 50 basis points to the negative. And that's pretty much to keep anyone from depositing money in francs, so they can keep the franc from getting out of control on the appreciation side. So, and we certainly see the strength of our dollar, and none of these countries like a strong currency as our country. So we know it's going to reverse itself. We just don't know when. But a lot of folks took advantage of they didn't take advantage, but they woke up today. They saw what gold can do, what gold is going to do, and it's a sign of the times to come. And when it happens, it'll happen like the Swiss making the announcement on the currency, something totally unexpected. And people, I think on the currency, it dropped like 30%, and it did come back, but the initial reaction was very severe. And one of these days, these severe reactions will not have a turnaround. So 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We got some great buys on gold and silver coins today. Give us a call. And Wendy Wilson from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
How are you doing?
I know she's there.
I'm here.
Okay. And what, did Frank forget to turn you on?
I'm thinking he might have. Can you hear
he
me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, hello, Melody. How you doing?
I'm doing just great, Wendy. Thanks. Thanks for joining us this afternoon, and you'll have to do without Alfred today.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll miss him. Totally miss him. Tell him hello for me. But, yeah, we got some good information here on some cancer-causing treatments. You know, we've heard about vaccines that can expose people to a higher risk of cancer. And we've also heard recently in the last year or so about early detection of studies using radiation, like, you know, mammograms, can increase a patient's risk of developing cancer. But now the hot news is a lot of this research that is coming out that there's another layer of risk, and that is the use of antibiotics. So antibiotics, pretty much the most overprescribed drug in the history of modern medicine. And even physician and researchers agree that more than 10 million unnecessary antibiotic medications are given every year just in the area of pediatrics. So a commonly known risk of using antibiotics, as we know, they're overused. So bacterial infections, you know, we develop that resistance and makes it more difficult as time goes on to treat bacterial infections. But this new research that has been published since 2000, 2004, let's see, 2010, and now 2014, all picking up steam that you can increase, especially for a woman, you can increase your risk of having breast cancer if you use antibiotics. The increase is almost two times. So you increase your use of breast cancer if you're taking anywhere from 1 to 25 rounds of antibiotics over a course of 17 years, according to the study. And this study was published in, let's see, the International Journal of Cancer. Another study that was done in 2010 by the University of Athens in Greece also corroborated that, and that was published in the Journal of Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety. And let's see what else. Also in the UK, they published in 2014, and they also presented this information, Melanie, to the American Society for Clinical Oncology that shows there's an increase also in the risk of colon cancer when you use antibiotics. So this is just a really important announcement because antibiotics have a lot of action in the system. People just don't realize what they're doing. They just think that it's killing the bacterial infection, but it's also killing healthy bacteria as well. Now, there's this book I want to mention. The book is by Dr. Simon Sini. The book is Cancer is a Fungus. Have you heard about this book, Melanie?
No, I haven't.
Well, he's an oncologist in Rome, and he believes that cancer really is a fungus that releases a lot of carbon dioxide byproducts and also 80 different toxic chemicals, he says, which are similar to formaldehyde. He says the fungus will feed on sugar and carbohydrates and refined foods. So he says, actually, cancer, he says, is an advanced form of fungus, and it's all caused by candida. And what is one of the major causes of candida or yeast infections, Melanie?
You tell us, Wendy.
Antibiotics. Yeah. So you see the connection there. You get an overgrowth of yeast in the digestive tract, and it can be a problem. And this kind of prompted me to talk about this because of the latest spin in the media that came out in the Journal of Science, which said that, 75% of the cases on cancer are just bad luck. Did you hear about that?
Hear about that one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, based on other scientific research, that's not the case. And I suspect that the reason they're promoting this cancer is just bad luck, message is that people won't try to correct their lifestyles and help themselves, help their body heal itself, because there is a genetic influence that was reported in a study that was published in the National Academy of Science in 2008, and they said that there's a tremendous impact in the prevention, even cure of cancer, when you change the foods you eat. So foods and even poisons or toxins change our DNA and can help or hinder our recovery from serious disease. So this research actually proved that nutrition, when you change to a healthier lifestyle, has a real positive impact on your genes, which can defeat the cancer and also switch off the mutated genes that promote cancer. So eating more raw fruits and vegetables, more nutrition, more enzymes will go a long way at helping the body recover from a serious disease like cancer. So don't think it's just bad luck. You've been dealt a bad card, a hand of cards. That's not the – don't even go there. And, of course, you can use a lot of herbs to
– go ahead. Know, they're doing all this DNA testing to see if you fall under, the family of cancer. And we had the one actress who removed her breasts because she didn't have cancer, but because she was at risk of getting cancer. All they would have to do is change or introduce a healthier way of eating. If your DNA, you can actually change your DNA through...
Right. Yeah, Dr. Carly's been on my show. She's written articles about this where, you can reverse a lot of DNA damage. And you can do that through, your lifestyle. You could do that through, she uses a lot of homeopathic products, but I use herbs. You could do it through both. And so she's a big believer in your goose isn't cooked, as it were, just because, you have a precursor, they say, to serious disease. So there's a lot you can do in order to change that element. So if vaccines and toxins can, have an adverse effect, then, good nutrition can reverse that and even prevent it. Like it can prevent the mutation of genes, as this one research study that they published in the National Academy of Sciences. And it was a nutritional the whole study was based on epigenetics and how food affects your genetics. It was just really incredible research. And so that was back in 2008. So you know how some of these new studies just forget all that other stuff, right?
Right, right. So when people rely, people get sick, people get the flu. I've heard this flu season, part of my family and other people have gotten this flu. It puts them in bed for 2 or 3 days. I'm not sure antibiotics is something that can actually help you when you're fighting the flu. But are germs getting stronger or are we getting weaker?
both. When you use antibiotics, Dr. Anthony Morris said that the antibiotics and also your vaccines, even your influenza vaccines, weaken the immune system. So, yeah. And when you have, you know, drug-resistant germs going around, bacterials, so you've got it from both ends. So this is why I have been saying for years that when people use a lot of modern medicine products for simple things, even allergies, colds, flus, they're really putting their immune system in the wheelchair, and then they expect that immune system to run a marathon and defend them against, let's say, a pandemic, and it can't do it. So when we talk about immune boosted, Melody, what we're trying to do is restore the immune system to its normal function, where a lot of these other medical treatments have suppressed it and try to weaken and defeat it. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about immune boosting, helping the body to recover.
Okay. Yeah, because I know, yeah, the flu, I've heard several people just seriously become ill this year, and we know why doctors prescribe antibiotics, but, you know, people are so easily, I mean, look at our shelves in the grocery stores or in the Rite Aids and the drug stores, all that medicine that is available for people, and they go and they try all these over-the-counter, you know, cold cures, and all they have to do is eat that apple a day to keep the doctor away, right?
Right. The natural vitamin C goes a long way. A lot of people, you know, get that airborne product that's, I think, $10 or something. And all that is vitamin C. It's a fizzy thing. You put it in water or something. But a lot of your immune boost herbs have that vitamin C, but in higher concentrations, along with manganese, magnesium, and zinc, and some other nutrients that the immune system desperately needs to be strong against flu bugs this time of year. And you're right, antibiotics don't help with viral infections, and that's why the pharmaceutical companies are going to viral drugs, because there's more viruses than bacterial infections now.
How difficult is it to use herbs?
Well, it's not. First, you got to.
I mean, people are just used to opening up a container, popping a pill or two, whatever vitamin,
right,
and so forth. And this is just a little bit of a different way to take many of the natural things that are available.
Right. Well, you know, this is why it's kind of a learning curve when you try to use something new. But once it's just like brushing your teeth, after you start using it, you get used to it, and you can actually listen to your body. My kids now are in their early 20s, and they know what herb to use when they start to feel under the weather. So they've got acclimated to using herbs. Like Kate, she's got those glands in her neck. Whenever she comes in contact with some foreign pathogen that's going to try to make her sick, that's the first indication she gets, is her glands feel tender in her neck. So she runs for the mullein tincture, because that soothes the glands. And then, of course, then she'll take the Three Amigos pack, which is an immune booster. But there's lots that people can do. There are basic doses, but there's wiggle room in the doses. We try to teach people how to do that. Our new 15th anniversary product catalog is kind of a teaching tool in that way. Not only does it list the herbal products and what's in them, it shows you how you can use them in single doses by themselves, or use with additional herbal products to magnify or empower the dose. So there's lots to be learned, but it's not going to be rocket science.
Well, give us some information, Wendy. We're just about out of time before heading into this first break. Give us your contact information, please.
Sure. They could give us a call toll-free at 866-229-3663, 866-229-3663. And, of course, we do have a website, thepowerherbs.com, thepowerherbs.com. Thanks, Melanie. Good to talk to you.
All righty. Thank you, Wendy. And you'll be back next Wednesday. And we look forward to it. We'll be heading into a break. And thank you, folks.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand. Have a plan. Have peace and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Does the cost and risk of conventional healthcare concern you? Wouldn't you prefer inexpensive solutions to health problems rather than disease management? If so, tune into Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest tonight is James Corbett. James moved to Japan in 2004. He's been publishing the Corbett Report for the past 8 years as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly news letter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. So welcome, James.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on. Always a pleasure
always
to talk to you.
Enjoy. Always enjoy it. I look forward to it. One of my people ask me, what did you do during the weekend? I usually say, what's a weekend? But what's the highlight? You know, this is one of the highlights of my week, these interviews. And it's that may be testimony to I really don't get out that much.
I guess so.
This is one of my highlights.
Or we're just that type of person. Why not?
Yeah, I understand. It's not exactly a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll. It's another classification, perhaps. Got a headline here from the Associated Press says Japan cabinet okays record military budget with eye on China. All right, Japan is allegedly, 5 trillion yen, $42 billion defense budget. It's gone up. Oh, wait a second. They endorsed, their total budget is 96 trillion yen for the total budget and 5 trillion for defense. Does this signify trouble? Is this just an ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure? Is it significant or just a gesture?
I think for the time being, it is not significant in the sense that I don't think that this is going to lead to any sort of imminent conflict. It is obviously significant because the trend obviously puts Japan and China, you know, at loggerheads, and with the possibility that even if it isn't really in the game plan per se, of course, tensions in naval predicaments can always lead to events, even if they're not necessarily planned that way. So it's always worrying with this kind of rhetoric, but not, I don't think any sort of imminent conflict is going to happen from it. But it does show that, as we've been noting here for years now, the defense budgets of all of the main players in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, area have been increasing steadily over the past several years, and there's no sign that that's going to change in the new year, unfortunately. And I think that ultimately, probably the easiest way to understand this, I mean, not only obviously because these types of budgets always are good for the crony capitalists in the positions near government who benefit directly from these, but also it's a politically useful thing because obviously people like to rally around the flag in any nation, and it plays as well here in Japan as it does in the U.S. or anywhere else. And that might explain why, in fact, Prime Minister Abe's approval rating actually went up slightly this past month, which is head-scratching to me. I can't think of any reason whatsoever why his approval rating would be going up at this point, especially considering the economic doldrums that Japan continues to linger in, except for moves like this, which again always play well with his political base and sort of appeal to patriotism. So I think that's the way we can probably make most sense of this on both sides, on the Japanese side, the Chinese side, and every other side here in the East China Sea area.
If we don't have nuclear weapons, if Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons at its disposal, what are the chances that Japan can throw up a genuine defensive shield that's able to hold China at bay?
Well, you see, that's an interesting if in that statement, because it's not at all clear that Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons, not in the sense that they have weapons actually ready at the moment. But as I've pointed out on my podcast a number of times, the nuclear energy industry is an adjunct of the nuclear weapons industry. It is. It provides the fuel for the nuclear bombs, basically, is the shorthand way of putting it. And so it has been, I think, quietly understood for a very long time that Japan's nuclear energy industry is such that it could quite easily and quite quickly produce into nuclear weapons manufacturing if and when that time came. And just along that note, I mean, we get little bits and pieces of this this puzzle in the news headlines sometimes. There was an interesting story a couple of years ago that revealed a secret program through which the Japanese government was, for example, allowing the American military to transit nuclear materials and even nuclear weapons through Japan in the 70s and 80s, completely contrary to everything that Japan said publicly and what they had committed to with their non-nuclear principles. Also, some secret plutonium deals that had been going on between the U.S. and Japan. And then just last June, we had this interesting story about the IAEA talking about how Japan had enough undeclared plutonium to make 80 nuclear bombs. And just contrast that to the types of problems that Iran has to deal with its nuclear energy issue. And Japan can have 80 nuclear bombs worth of plutonium undeclared that the IAEA kind of finds out about through the back door. And no one seems to raise a big fuss about this or raises the possibility that we might have to go in and bomb Japan, of course. So, I mean, again, just part of the nuclear hypocrisy that's par for the course. So I don't think it's clear at all that Japan isn't capable of being a nuclear nation if and when they want to be.
I think if there was, even if they didn't have nuclear weapons of their own, I'm going to suppose that if push came to shove and it really looked like there was an imminent conflict between Japan and China, the United States would supply nuclear weapons.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. If it came to a certain point of that conflict, I think you're exactly right. And we have to keep in mind that the official nuclear doctrine of the U.S. Military right now is to keep first strike nuclear warfare on the table as an option. That is still in the nuclear warfare doctrine, as reaffirmed, I think, as recently as 2012, the last time I looked, the latest strategy documents. So, I mean, let's not be Pollyanna about this. The American nuclear umbrella is over the entire East Asia area. And, of course, Taiwan is usually seen as a flashpoint, has historically been seen as one, but Japan could equally be one within the growing conflict with China.
I understand. It's dangerous. One of those things where you can hope that everyone, you know, stays reasonable, sensible, and doesn't do something completely stupid.
Just one other thing that I should mention. I think it's almost time for the annual joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, where they do such things as drop dummy nuclear warheads on the Korean Peninsula as part of those exercises, which North Korea always strongly protests, obviously, but South Korea and the U.S. continue to persist in that every single year, and I think that's just coming up. And I believe I saw a headline to the effect that North Korea is offering to halt its own nuclear weapons or nuclear program with the proviso that the U.S. and South Korea end their joint exercises. And from what I understand, there's no chance that that's going to happen.
What do you suppose the chances are that the United States would find some pretext to actually nuke North Korea? They're not big enough to do anything in return. It's the sort of thing where, under right circumstances, the President of the United States could, in theory, gain some popularity by saying, oh my gosh, these people have done something just terrible, so we've decided to nuke them. Is that completely irrational?
Well, I mean, it is irrational. The question is it possible? And unfortunately, those two are in different questions. But you know, I think I would go back to the 2D and 3D geopolitical chess games that we talked about before. So in the 2D nation-state kind of warfare system, I mean, you could imagine something like that happening, but there's no way that you could imagine that happening without China obviously being immediately and directly involved in that, because China is sort of North Korea's big brother in a way. I mean, they're the only nation that kind of has the normal diplomatic relations with them, and obviously that would be seen as a direct assault on the doorstep of China in a dramatic escalation. So from that perspective, I mean, that would be basically tantamount to almost a declaration of war on China, pretty much, if that happened. So I don't expect that would happen in that 2D game. The only way that that could even be feasible would be in the 3D chess game that I like to talk about, where, of course, a lot of these oligarchs in various countries are linked in through various organizations at the top. If there was a plan to create that type of instability to lead to a warfare scenario, because, as we've talked about before, if you want to change the opinions of the world and make something like a world government possible, you have to go through a period of warfare first to make people beg for the solution. If they wanted to set off a war, that might be one possible way to do it. I don't see any indication that that is really being seriously considered, but again, you never really know.
But I'm talking about if North Korea did something really serious, not just hack into the Sony computers, but hack into Dancing with the Stars.
Right. Yeah.
And that might be enough where Obama or whoever is in office says, oh my gosh, the beasts have, they've cost us Dancing with the Stars. We're going to have to nuke them. I've got another article here from Associated Press. Russian ruble falls further as oil price tumbles. And they're complaining, oh my gosh, the Russian ruble is falling. That's not news precisely. Here's another one along the same from Reuters headline. Russia's financial crisis may bury Putin's Eurasian dream. Now, if we can believe the media, the Russians are facing almost an economic collapse based on the falling price of oil and the increasing inflation that's afflicting the Russian ruble. Right? Now, I'm not convinced that circumstances are as bleak in Russia as some of the media would suggest, and part of the reason for that is, here's another headline from Reuters, just from yesterday. It says the headline is U.S. to back $2 billion in loan guarantees for Ukraine. Now, the United States plans to provide up to $2 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine this year, the U.S. Treasury said on Tuesday, as part of a broader international package to stave off bankruptcy. Now, my point is, while they're saying, oh my gosh, Russia is in big trouble, but we're going to have to kick in $2 billion to keep Ukraine from going bankrupt. Who's in more trouble right now, the Ukraine or Russia?
I would say that Ukraine is in more immediate dire straits and has been for some time. I mean, that's what precipitated this whole crisis, was the point at which Ukraine was flailing about trying to, anyway, to cut a deal to cover its debts. And obviously that led to the whole Euromaidan and all. And we know the rest of that story. So I think Ukraine is in some desperate financial straits and does desperately require that funding to even sort of stopgap the government in the meantime. So they're definitely, I think, first on that sort of economic chopping block. But I'm not so skeptical about the idea that Russia is in serious financial difficulties. I think certainly with the trend lines that they're on right now, the trend absolutely is towards economic devastation for the Russian economy. And this is right now, I mean, we have, for example, we had recently an interest rate hike by the Russian Central Bank as kind of an emergency maneuver to try to stop some of the capital that's flowing out of the country and try to stop up the ruble. That worked for a little time, but now it's recrashed, basically. All they have really is they have some reserves that they can continue to basically sell off in order to try to again stop up the ruble, but they can only continue to do so for a limited amount of time. I don't know, I don't have the numbers in front of me how many dollars they have for their reserve holdings, but it's probably not enough if they're just going to try to use that as a way of staving off this ruble collapse. And of course, this is all tied back to the oil price, which, I mean, we've talked about it a lot and you've heard about it a lot, but that, I mean, there's no way around it. The falling oil price is a huge, huge hit on the Russian economy. And again, whether or not that was intentional, I think it probably was, but whether or not it was intentional, it is having that effect right now. And as you noted, it is having knock-on effects on the ability of this Eurasian Economic Union to prosper in the way that I think Putin had envisioned it. And I actually just wrote about this in the Forecaster last weekend under the headline, Another Headache for Moscow. It's up on the internationalforecaster.com right now, where I talked about this Eurasian Economic Union, which for years and years, Putin has been talking about, and he said this is a world historical moment, and you know, it's going to basically be a rival institution to the European Union, and it's going to eventually one day stretch from Lisbon to Vladivostok, and this kind of lofty rhetoric about this EEU. But as I point out in that article, at this moment anyway, it basically looks almost dead on arrival. It currently links Russia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and I think I'm looking at the wrong list of nations there. It's in that block anyway. It's floating around in that nexus, and I think Armenia is or is about to become a member of this as well. But it's all of those nations are hurting right now because of the falling ruble and even such things as economic migration from Central Asia into Russia, which had been quite common in recent years, is now starting to stop and even reverse to some extent, and economic sending money back to nations from migrant workers is starting to stop up. So there is a significant problem happening right now in the Russian economy. I think there's no two ways around that.
I think we'll take a break right now for some commercial announcements, and then when we come back, I'll have a couple more questions for James Corbett from the Corbett Report. Let's see if Frank is willing to start the commercials 30 seconds early. He is. All right, we'll be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we've been talking a little about the significance of price of oil falling and how it's affected Russia and perhaps created financial turmoil over there. And I don't doubt that the falling price of oil has done harm. It just has to be because it's a big source of income for Russia. You cut anybody's income, they have a certain amount of suffering to go through or difficulty. But what disturbs me, confuses me, is the idea, we hear the reports that, oh my gosh, they're having serious inflation in Russia. Well, we've had quantitative easing for most of the time since 2008 in this country. And the whole idea behind quantitative easing was to cause enough inflation to prevent deflation. And everyone's been arguing in the currency wars in the world that they want to devalue their currency, that is to say, cause more inflation to affect the value of their currency, make their currency worth less so their currencies are more competitive and their exports are more competitive on the world economic market. And everybody say, yeah, we want more inflation. We want more inflation. Russia's getting more inflation. Is the inflation hurting Russia, or is the inflation actually stimulating the Russian economy?
But I think we have to differentiate a couple of things. I mean, obviously, the exporters want an inflated, devalued currencies. But people, for example, people in Russia who are buying goods that have been imported with Russian rubles obviously want the ruble to be as strong as possible. So there are competing interests even within each and every economy, and no difference there. The question is really consumer price index, consumer inflation versus the type of inflation on the macrocosmic level, and whether or not the country is a net exporter or net importer, to try to find out, you know, which is going to be most beneficial for the country as a whole. But I would say that for the average Russian going about their daily business, I mean, to the extent that they do rely on imported goods, it's obviously going to be painful to have a crashing ruble. And that's the same in all of these various countries, where economists will talk about how, you know, I mean, it's great for the yen to be devalued because Japan is obviously a heavily exporter type nation. So isn't that great? But so much of the Japanese economy depends on imports, including imported energy, obviously, a lot of LNG. That's going to increase in price as the yen gets devalued. And that's going to hurt the average consumer as much as it does some of these corporations. So again, there's always a balance to this. And I think for the average Russian, There's an interesting question there, because actually Russia has obviously levied some of its own reverse sanctions against various Western countries, so they're relying less on imported dairy and meat and some other products. So that might not actually be affecting them as much as they're forced to source locally and buy locally.
Which will create jobs. There'll be other jobs that are going to be lost, but there's a question of balance here, and I'm wondering, you know, if inflation is so great that it was going to stimulate our economy, how is inflation not so good for the Russian economy?
Right. And I think you always have to scrutinize who is saying that about inflation or deflation and what perspective they're coming from and what interests they're serving. Because, again, it's a mixed bag. Whenever there's inflation, there are winners and losers, and same with deflation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But one of the things that is true, from my perspective, when you have inflation, you pay off your debts with cheaper dollars. This is a fundamental motivation that virtually everyone who's ever taken out a mortgage has been assured that there will be inflation, and it seems like a lot of money now, but by the time you get toward the end of the mortgage, it'll only be a fraction. The dollars that you're paying on your mortgage will only be a fraction in terms of purchasing power of what the dollars are today. We're going to pay off our debts with cheaper dollars thanks to inflation, and what that means is we will legally rob our creditors. The borrowers are subsidized by inflation. The creditors, they take a loss. If we go into deflation, what's supposed to happen is the dollar becomes more valuable. Instead of paying off your debt with cheaper dollars, you pay off your debt with more expensive dollars, which is bad for borrowers, but it's great for creditors. Right? You would think that deflation is the reverse of inflation, but there's a problem. When you have deflation, you make it less likely that the borrowers will pay off their debts at all. Not a question, which means the creditors are again going to lose with a fiat currency. Mathematically, if you can sustain deflation, fine, the creditors would win and the borrowers would lose. But the borrowers are just going to quit and say, I can't pay that. Here, take the keys to the house. I'm out of here. Which implies... that if you're using a fiat currency, it necessarily means that ultimately the creditors are going to be robbed, either by inflation or even by deflation. Creditors get robbed. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. And there's actually a few different things going on here. Not only do you have an increased risk of default in a deflationary environment where people just can't keep up because their dollars are the debt is costing more, relatively speaking, but also, of course, you disincentivize people to borrow in the first place. Who's going to want to go into that long-term mortgage in an environment where they're expecting the dollar to actually strengthen in the meantime? And then, on top of that, I mean, there are the sort of macroeconomic effects, generally speaking. Who's going to want to spend money when just keeping it in the bank account might actually be better, might be the best investment you can make in that deflationary environment. So it actually slows down the economy as a whole, which obviously has knock-on effects, which causes the layoffs and then causes even further decrease in spending. And that becomes the deflationary cycle, which can become a deflationary depression like we saw in the 30s with the contraction of the economy. So this is, I mean, again, you're right to point out this is the type of expectation that we haven't seen in a very long time. The expectation has always been geared towards inflation. We are now getting caught in that deflationary undertow, and it can have some huge effects on banking, on the economy in general, on every aspect of people's lives. And I think we're only starting to see some of those effects, one of which, actually, here's another shoe that might drop more quickly than people are expecting. I'm, of course, from Calgary, Alberta in Canada, which is known as the Texas of the North because it has for a long time been centered very much on the oil industry and has been home to the oil industry in Western Canada. And, of course, the tar sands has been the focus of a lot of that economic activity in the last several years, which has been enabled by oil prices over $70, $80, $90, $100 a barrel, tar sands becomes a profitable venture. Down at under $50 a barrel, definitely not so profitable, and if it's even sustainable at all. And as a result, what are we starting to see? But some worrying signs for the Albertan economy. Anyway, we see the Calgary Home Price Index has just dropped its biggest 2-month drop in the last 2 years, which on the big scheme of things may not seem like much when you look at the big long timeline. But if this is a trend that is related to decreasing oil prices that we expect to continue, we could see a very sharp contraction, for example, in the Calgary home market. And this is worrying because this is part of a Canadian housing bubble that people have been pointing out for a few years now. But the experts, the credentialed expert talking heads on TV, have been telling us, don't worry, it's going to slow down, but it'll be a slowdown. It'll be a nice soft landing. It's not going to be a sharp crash. Well, that's exactly what we could be looking at if these trend lines continue in this deflationary environment, with oil prices dropping and the economy starting to contract. And if that starts to happen, we could see the Canadian banking sector, which a lot of people have talked about as having survived a lot of the craziness of what happened in the U.S. during the subprime crisis, we could see some of that starting to hit home. And there's an excellent article up on Zero Hedge right now, Canada Crude Contagion, Calgary Home Prices Drop Most in 2 Years, that shows the household debt to income ratio of both Canada and the U.S. And it shows that in the U.S. we saw throughout the 1990s and early 2000s that debt to income ratio increasing. In, I believe, somewhere around 2002, 2003, it actually crossed over 100. So that meant over 100% people were more in debt than they actually had income in the United States. And that started to ease off in around the 2008 crash. Obviously, people started to pay back some of their debts, and that went back down debt from its 120% high. In Canada, the line is pretty much continues straight up. And now household debt to income is now 160%. So Canadians are very, very much finding themselves behind the eight ball when it comes to this. And as you say, I mean, deflationary environments are bad for debtors. And Canada is.
But they may even be dead. They're bad for debtors. But if the debtor, they're good for creditors if the debtor pays the bill.
Yeah. Exactly.
But if the debtor says, I'm out of here, then the creditors lose their capital again.
Exactly right. And if house prices are decreasing and people find it harder to even sell their house, or if the value of their home starts to go underwater, we could look at a very significant problem in Canada soon. And that might be one of the next shoes to drop. Who knows? Maybe the Cyprus-style bail-ins might happen next in somewhere like Canada, which has some systemic issues going on right now.
Well, you know, when I stop to think about it, you realize, recognize, and remember that the dollar became a pure fiat currency in 1971 when Nixon closed the gold window, and soon after it became the petrodollar in that it was implicitly backed by petroleum products from the oil-producing nations. That establishes a relationship between the dollar and crude oil that is powerful and perhaps profound. And it implies that if we want inflation for the dollar in order to limit, to diminish our own debt and encourage people to go out and spend, we have to have higher crude oil prices. On the other hand, if crude oil goes down, the dollar is going up in terms of purchasing power because it's a petrol currency. These aren't necessarily unrelated facts. Oh, the dollar just happens to be going up amazingly, almost. At the same time, the price of crude oil is falling. That's consistent with having a petrodollar, at least at first glance to me. Do you think that's reasonable?
Oh, of course, it's eminently reasonable, especially when you look at the fact that commodities prices are dropping across the board. Iron ore, copper, all of these prices are dropping simultaneously. Well, it's because they're all being measured in dollars. And I think there has to be a correlation between the strengthening of the dollar and the dropping of these commodity prices. That's at least one part of this equation. I think in the oil markets, it's more complicated than that. But that is one of the underlying factors, in the exact same way that the very loose monetary policy policy that we saw instituted with Greenspan, for example, after 9/11 and in the run-up to the 2008 bubble, we saw the run-up in oil prices as well. I think, again, we could see that a correlation there. The sort of easier, looser monetary policy, the weaker the dollar, the higher the oil prices, the stronger the dollar, the fact that the QE is coming to an end and everyone's expecting, at any rate, a lot of tightening in monetary policy means that commodity prices are dropping. So I think there's obviously a relation there.
Let's take, we've got about 3.5 minutes left on the program. Let's buzz over to Paris. And we've all heard about the publication, Charlie Hebdo, 12 people being shot and killed by Muslims. Do you think the Muslims have finally gone too far? Will this event precipitate a backlash against Muslims that is more profound than what we've seen in the past?
Well, two different questions again. I think the backlash is one question. Whether Muslims have gone too far is another question, because, again, I, being an eminently skeptical sort, remain open to other alternative explanations of what happened in Paris. And I certainly don't just take anyone's word for the fact that the people who ended up being accused for this were the people that we saw in those videos ostensibly committing these acts. I'm just inherently skeptical of such things, and I think there are a lot of things regarding this that don't add up. The question of the backlash, I think, is altogether different, because obviously this has been placed squarely at the foot of this self-proclaimed al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula fighters who supposedly committed this, and that's the general public's understanding of this. So I think obviously this is going to bring to a head the tensions that absolutely are there and are simmering in a lot of European nations right now. And we see that across the board. I mean, we see calls now in Switzerland and other places to tighten immigration from Muslim countries, ostensibly because of this incident. But obviously, I think these tensions have been going on for a very long time. So I think that that is absolutely the trend line. And it's, I mean, events like this, again, regardless of what actually happened or who was actually behind it, and for people who are interested in what could be an alternative explanation, I hope they will look into such things as Operation Gladio B and the idea of staged NATO terrorist attacks, which, again, did, I mean, under Operation Gladio did take place. We now know that a lot of the terrorist bombings, quote unquote, in Italy in the 1970s that were blamed on communists were, in fact, linked to NATO's Operation Gladio. So, again, there's a very important history that needs to be learned about the ways these attacks can be staged in order, precisely the exact point of Operation Gladio in its original context, as we know, again, from the declassified documents, is to create a strategy of tension which increases people's basically hatred of each other and increases the possibility of political saviors to swoop down and do these ridiculous photo ops for freedom of speech, even as every single one of the participants in that rally in one way or another jails bloggers or journalists or threatens them in various ways for speaking out against their own regimes. I mean, it's hypocrisy at a grand scale, and hopefully the public is waking up to this. I see signs that more people are starting to question these narratives, but is it enough, or will this actually result in the type of clash of civilizations as a self-fulfilling prophecy that they've been talking about for decades now?
Well, what you're suggesting is that the real impetus behind the million people that marched in Paris was not necessarily an aversion to Muslims, but an aversion to immigrants at a time when they are not sure that they're going to have their jobs or their nation is going to be economically secure. So perhaps this is a reaction. We're going to get the Muslims. But maybe what they're really talking about are the immigrants, are the ones that are really making France and other countries anxious. And you got 10 seconds to respond.
Yeah, I'd say I think it's both. If there's a Venn diagram, you have Muslims and immigrants, and they overlap, and I think that's where people's attention are being directed, and there are a lot of issues to pick out there. So maybe we can pick it up again next week.
We'll do it. All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. This was James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. Take a look. I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival. I'll be back with Melody manana. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
Still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man.
family.